Welcome to the Table Podcast, where we discuss issues of God and culture, brought to you by Dallas Theological Seminary.
Welcome to the Table. We discuss issues of God and culture, and our topic today is a little bit of an unusual one. We're going to be talking about identity, but we're also going to talk about how change in cultural context impacts identity. People form their identity, and identity itself is a complex topic, but then when you have people shift space, it also impacts the way you see yourself. And my guest is Jenny McGill, who is formerly at Dallas Seminary, but now is regional dean in Northern Indiana and Illinois for Indiana Wesleyan University. So welcome, Jenny. It's good to have you. And Jenny has written a book that is a summary of research that she did. It's entitled Religious Identity and Cultural Negotiation Toward a Theology of Christian Identity and Migration. And it really is a study. So let's talk about how does one even get to the point of studying something like this? Where did your interest in this topic come from?
Well, my undergrad was psychology, mm-hmm. and my master's was in intercultural studies. So when it came to studying at the doctoral level, I wanted to find a program that would allow me to study the concept of identity interdisciplinarily. So looking at it through different lenses of different fields of study. So that's where I started my previous social science background and then theology.
Okay. And then, of course, you had an experience with this because when you were here at Dallas, you were working with international students. Isn't that right?
Yes. I was hired basically off the street mm-hmm. when I was a student. They saw that I was always with foreign students, and they called me in to interview. They thought I might be a good fit. And I started as a part-time secretary and eventually went to direct the office from 2004 to 2014.
Okay, so you were dealing with the myriad of international students that we have coming through. And I take it that their experience in getting adjusted to a new culture fueled your interest in thinking about this topic.
Certainly. Most of the ministry I had done was overseas, so that mm-hmm. was my first exposure probably during the summer.
So this had happened to you as well?
Not to the same level, but yeah. certainly on a short-term mm-hmm. Perspective. And then working with foreign students, I was beginning to see and experience with them what they were going through and seeing patterns. And one of the other impetus to study was sometimes I would get questions in my office that we just didn't have data to answer.
Interesting. So where did you do your overseas? Where were you overseas?
I chose to become an international student. I had a sweet little host family, uh-huh. and I studied at King's College London.
Oh, okay. And well, England, that's not too radical a move. It's of course, we were in Scotland, so I know what that's like. And let's talk a little bit first about the value of switching cultures. What did you learn from that experience that proved to be valuable and may even have helped you think about how to do this study?
Sociologically, we're prone to in-group bias. Mm-hmm. So anytime you can cross a barrier or a boundary, a border, you are getting exposure mm-hmm. and awareness, and you're not going to automatically think it up. Mm-hmm. So being able to see difference and observe difference then creates more, even new neural pathways of how you might go about doing something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my wife and I, when we moved to Germany and German society was structured very different than American society. There were certain things she could get away with doing in American society, she couldn't get away with doing in German society, that kind of thing. We talk about living by a different set of rules. And the rules, you don't get to make the rules, and yet you have to play by the rules. And you aren't necessarily saying whether the rules are good or bad, but in some cases you discover, hey, this part of life works more efficiently this way than the way I was raised to live it, that kind of thing. And so it opens up possibilities for thinking about how to live and how to interact that's different. It pulls you outside your own world, so you're able to look at what you experienced and what you grew up with slightly differently. We found all that to be pretty valuable.
Yes, agreed. Even in my own experience, we have what I call compassionate imagining, mm-hmm. that when you are challenged beyond what you're comfortable thinking, then you begin to either identify with the other person in whatever respect, but also challenge to evaluate, okay, what's biblical, what's cultural, what's transnational,
Mm-hmm. And so it leads to a very interesting opportunity to learn and think differently and interact. And as you said, it pulls you out of your own in-group. It develops, the word I use is empathy. It creates a sense of empathy and identification with the way different people live and sometimes why they do it, that kind of thing. And all that ends up being very helpful in forming kind of a almost global's exaggerated because you can't live in all spheres simultaneously, but a more global perspective about life and the way people live.
Even just more than one mm-hmm. is helpful, and it's a good start. You would never anticipate someone else's need the way you would know the needs in your own group.
Mm-hmm.
So any exposure, awareness, learning different things is valuable.
Okay, so that's the background. We're trying to think about what kind of experience this is to kind of shift space. And what that does to people and how people think about their identity. So let's kind of do this in two steps. Let's talk about identity first, which is already complex enough, and then think about what happens when a person who has an identity moves into a new space. So first, let's talk about identity. What did you work on, and how should people think about identity, their own identity, as they think about saying, this is who I am?
Well, the concept of identity isn't singular, so mm-hmm. I would say you could even say the concept of identities.
Yes, we do the same thing with cultures. Yes, exactly.
But if we were to speak of it as a singular concept, I would say it's one self-view or one self-understanding. Mm-hmm. And you have different identities. So part of research is you almost have to categorize the subject or the whatever you're looking at, whether it's religious identity, ethnic identity, sexual identity, gender identity. I mean, all of those are grouped. But you have more than one.
Mm-hmm.
So part of identity is in your given life and context, whether it's, I like what one researcher has quantified as relationships, rituals, and restrictions mm-hmm. that would define your identities, whether mm-hmm. they're ascribed. Sometimes identities are given to you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're born a daughter.
Right, right.
And sometimes they're achieved, so you decide to become an astronaut.
That's right, yeah.
So both of those could either, some identities are put on us as individuals. We certainly have identities in which groups we're in.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of that.
So when you were telling me is when you were born, they didn't come out, Jenny McGill, scholar.
Yeah, no, that I learned by God's grace.
Yeah. So and that combination, that interaction forms our sense of how we see ourselves in the world, how we react to what goes on around us, that
yeah.
kind of thing, what we assess, what we view our skills as being, that kind of thing.
And identity can be studied through many lenses, as you know, and the mm-hmm. ones I chose were identity negotiation theory, which I won't go into the theorists, but mm-hmm. that was one angle that hadn't really been discussed. And mm-hmm. then the other that I really got interested in was a narrative view of identity,
mm-hmm.
that actually how we create meaning is through the stories we tell or what stories we feel a part of,
mm-hmm.
and that suddenly who we view ourselves to be is part of a narrative adventure.
So everybody's identity life has a story that's attached to which they attach significant events that kind of show who they are.
Sure. And from story, of course, you have lots of interactions that create that. But I think viewing it as a narrative format helped in or how I wanted to study identity. So there's such a thing called narrative identity mm-hmm. of how you tell your story over mm-hmm. life.
Okay. And of course, Christians are very familiar with that because obviously the giving of a testimony is a prime example of that kind of an exercise.
Mm-hmm.
You talked about the narrative identity. There was one other I missed.
Identity negotiation.
Okay, now what is that? Now, without getting too involved.
Right. Well, there were two people that came up with it separately as a title, and mm-hmm. they differ in their definitions somewhat. But basically, they're saying that identity shifts. Identity is both fixed and fluid.
Mm-hmm.
It is stable and yet changes over time.
Mm-hmm.
So they were looking at how any individual or group would negotiate their identity over time.
Right.
Where you have this amoebic, you know, it's like C.S. Lewis called it a curve and a waterfall, that the mm-hmm. physical atoms of our body are never the same, but uh-huh. they do cohere
right.
so that you're recognizable.
Okay. So, and that if people think about their lives, just the jobs they do or wherever, where they might have a company that they work for, but their expertise within the company might be shifting as they are with the company longer and longer. That's kind of an analogy for what we're talking about.
Sure.
Okay. So, okay, so let's talk about the research a little bit. What is it exactly that you studied? And because now we're talking about beyond identity, we're moving to the idea of, all right, identity in different spaces. How much does where I am impact how I see myself?
Well, that's exactly what I wanted to study.
Okay.
So half of the book is more theoretical, where I'm going through different individuals who have discussed identity, and then I combine discussing the concept of identity of what your Christian identity might be theologically. That's mm-hmm. the first half. The second half, then I pulled in the research I did internationally, thanks to all of the international graduates who participated, mm-hmm. to begin to see what they described happening to them. So for the, I had two sets of, not samples, but students. One set I interviewed, mm-hmm. and those were only returned migrants, and I focus on two particular areas where they were religious minorities in the world,
okay.
Christian religious minorities. So here you have a potential applicant who's a religious minority in their local context, but a member of the ethnic majority.
Okay.
Then when they came to Dallas, that flipped,
mm-hmm.
and they became a member of the religious majority, so to speak, in North Texas, but then suddenly a member of the ethnic minority. When those interviewees moved, then it flipped back. And
okay.
I wanted to study what their memory of, how they viewed themselves, what changed, because I was able to have them from before, during, and then after. The survey then for all the graduates was much larger, and I didn't get to access that information, but was able to relate it.
And so were you studying the impact of the move on the self-definition of their identity? Was that the focus of the study? What were you after?
Ultimately, I wanted to pull from their experience to give a message to North American Christians. And
okay.
I couldn't predict what that would be, but I just knew that they would have valuable things to say. So how they adjusted culturally,
mm-hmm.
I asked open-ended questions mm-hmm. and then followed where they took it, how their faith impacted the decisions they made, where they decided to live,
mm-hmm.
Did they migrate based on what, based on which reasons?
Hmm. And okay, so you did this. How large a sample were you working with?
So I looked at international graduates from 1983 to 2013,
mm-hmm.
30 years, and there were almost, of all the people I contacted, I received 405 surveys.
Okay. And so it's a 30-year period. Did you do any slicing of the years within which this happened, or did you treat it all as kind of one sample?
I took the quantitative sample was all at one point in time,
okay.
where they were in the U.S. Based on their experiences.
Okay.
So a lot of the questions were numerical, and some of the questions were, what are your concerns based on identity? How did they evaluate their religious, ethnic? One simple thing is I just wanted to see how they categorize their multiple identities. Which did they value? Maybe one over another. How were they talking about it?
Okay, let's zero in on that because that's interesting. So obviously they've got a nationality, they've got an ethnicity, they've got a religious orientation. Beyond those three, are there any other?
Those are the three I limited to.
Okay. So and so they're processing that experience. You say they're moving from minority to majority status and back to minority status with regard to both ethnicity and religion, and of course obviously their national place is changing because they're moving, and so you said you wanted this to be for North Americans. All right, were you trying to help create an understanding of what it is for a person to change their situation, or were you trying to study what happens to people when they make that move? Was it a little of both? What's going on there?
It was pretty open-ended, but I from my experience with foreign students, they had a powerful message of how to navigate life mm-hmm. as a minority identity, mm-hmm. and in this case, Christian, mm-hmm. of how do you stay nimble and adapt and adjust with all the parameters of challenges ethically mm-hmm. of how to live. So that, I think I mostly wanted to hear their opinion on how to live as a minority.
Okay. Now, that raises an interesting question. Why in the world would you think about even going there? I mean, in the sense of, was there something that you saw that you thought was important to appreciate that took you to that kind of a question? Because most Christians, at least in the United States, would sit here and say, well, we don't see ourselves as a we don't see ourselves in cultural minority terms, or if we do, we're shifting into that realm. Is there something like that going on?
Maybe because most of my ministry was overseas. Uh-huh. I was in environments where Christians weren't majority.
Okay.
I don't know if I sought experiences where I discovered what it was. I have an interracial marriage. Mm-hmm. So maybe that was exposure. I think it was multiple things.
Huh, interesting. So, okay, so let's talk a little bit about the results. What did you begin to learn as a result of doing this study?
One theme that came through both quantitatively and qualitatively was this sense of calling, mm-hmm. that whatever their identities were and however they arranged their particular pattern of conceptual self-understanding, the reasons they did things were motivated by their faith, even the migration aspect, whether to stay in the U.S., leave, come, where to study. So it was all very integrated. Hmm. And I think learning from their stories how their identities migrated, but also they physically migrated based on a sense of stewardship. So themes of stewardship, calling, a sense of obligation to bless others because that God had blessed them. All those themes are in Scripture, and I saw it playing out in these students as well.
So do you have some examples of this type of thing about what motivated? I mean, I can imagine that obviously if you're dealing with students in the pool, they've come here to get their education and to better equip themselves for ministry back home. So you've got that dimension. The other thing that's in the back of my mind is the dissonance of doing that. In other words, coming into a different culture, learning in an environment completely different from the one they're eventually going to minister in, and then having to make that adjustment on the way back, which is certainly a significant thing to have to wrestle with. So let's do this in two parts. I'm thinking out loud. On the one hand, what's motivating a student here is just the opportunity to primarily to be educated and to do it in a different kind of environment and see what's going on in a different part of the global Christian scene?
Well, I think for these students, I mean, yes. Well, globally, studying in the U.S. is still a great advantage mm-hmm. academically.
Right.
These students, I believe, are coming to Dallas Seminary for the theological training. That's motive, you know.
Right.
They chose this school over another for that reason.
Right.
But then I think they were surprised for those who returned that I interviewed, they were surprised at the resistance they ran into, presumably going back to their home country.
Having come overseas.
Mm-hmm, because they were perceived as Americanized.
Huh.
Some of their ideas were not as readily accepted because they were different. And why were they different? Because they were in America. So uh-huh. the ideas could be chalked up as, well, that's just, that you just bring back America, you know.
Yeah.
They don't want any of that. Instead of really looking at maybe what they had combined of both that would be beneficial. And I think there was, in some cases, it was threatening
mm-hmm.
because they did have more knowledge and training, and it had been 4 years, and nobody stayed, even the people who stay in the original country of origin, they haven't stayed the same. They've changed in 4 years. And if there's not, another thing that came out in the research was, if you're not maintaining that connection physically, you know, Proximus, either taking trips home, Skype, or some connection, then you lose that. And mm-hmm. in 4 years, nobody's in the same place.
Interesting. So you basically have two to what I would say plates like, you know, continents that are moving simultaneously at different rates, and so you don't end up reconnecting in the way that you left the relationship.
Right. And even for now, for those who had maintained a connection of some mm-hmm. sort of proximity, whether verbal or physical, those were maintained, mm-hmm. obviously. I mean, if you mm-hmm. don't spend time in a relationship, it changes
right.
either way. But certainly that was a factor. So I think part of the transition returning was a surprise. And then they had to students at the time had to constantly shift being in a new environment. And I give narratives in the book about what their experiences were that were unique and striking. And I tried to make, I mean, all their stories were interesting. So I pulled that into the research.
Interesting. So really we've got two parts here. We've got what happens to the person when they first make the move and come into a new environment. And then there's the whole experience of what happens when they take all of that and everything that's happened to them back. Clearly not the same person that they were, and with a set of influences that the community that they're ministering to may not have any real understanding of at the same time. So it's a double transition.
Readapt what they've adapted to learn to a new community that was an old community. You know, it's interesting.
Yeah,
and then through all of that identity formation. Mm-hmm. They had changes in perception. I tracked what they said changed the most behaviorally mm-hmm. versus, you know, the practices or their thought patterns, what changed for mm-hmm. them. And there were thematic units that were similar. And then ultimately all of this identity formation, the big theological point I make at the end of the book is their physical migration is a metaphor for our spiritual migration mm-hmm. and identity.
So we have someone coming from, I take it that the students that you interviewed were from a range of nations.
64.
Okay, 64 mm-hmm. nations out of 405 students. Is that what you're saying? So that's, okay, that's a pretty good swath of our world. And they, boom, land in the United States. They may be struggling with the first language in some cases. They're certainly learning a completely new culture. What are they dealing with, and what does that mean for their identity? What was your study showing in terms of what the experience is like?
Again, I assessed their religious identity, ethnic and national. And one of the difficulties they had in coming and studying in the U.S. was their, well, first of all, obviously they weren't ethnic majority anymore, but even the way Americans viewed race and culture is different than maybe they would have in their home country. So what was different was how Americans would translate the same material, so to speak, of a certain entity, whether it be how do you interact at church, how do you treat a person of a different color. All those things were upside down for the most part.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And by upside down, you mean
different. So one student went into a store at the mall, and the way she was viewed because of her dress, she could tell she was being treated differently based on her outfit.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she wouldn't have gotten that in her home culture because they all wear the same outfit.
Right, right.
For the most part. And and they actually were negative, treated her negatively based mm-hmm. on her outfit. And it wasn't even the color of her skin. It was the perception of her dress.
Interesting. And of course, this happens in multiple ways and multiple levels. So it's reinforced and makes the experience of transition difficult. So it really is different. It's the difference between being at home and really recognizing I am a stranger in a strange land.
Yeah. And even though you might know English mm-hmm. functionally, the words, you use different words and they mean different things. So mm-hmm. the word soon mm-hmm. or friend, mm-hmm. I mean, those are going to have different definitions based on which culture you're from.
Mm-hmm.
Or even the word colored, if you want to talk about race mm-hmm. and ethnic identity. The word colored in the U.S. is used for certain people, whereas the word colored in South Africa connotes a different type of person.
Interesting.
The way you define the same word changes.
So you've got the same language in some ways, but it's not the same language. So there are all these adjustments to make. So how do people make the adjustment? It seems to me they've got about a couple of ways to do it. They can try and forge it on through their own, or they can find someone who can kind of help them negotiate the culture.
A lot of times the graduates or students that came already knew about U.S. culture more than the reverse. So the difficulty they would have was that Americans didn't understand their culture. But because of, you know, Hollywood being globalized,
right,
they knew more about our culture.
At least Hollywood America. Yeah.
So I think that was a challenge, is how they're surprised at how little the U.S. culture might know about the rest of the world.
About their world. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I actually think that's a generic cross-cultural experience in some ways, that that you go to a foreign place and inevitably you know you're adjusting because you're learning what they're all about, depending on how much exposure they've had to the culture you come out of, they may know next to nothing about where you're coming from.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We found that when we went overseas, we were fortunate. We were able to, in both locations, because we spent a significant time in Germany, a significant time in Scotland, two very different experiences, because one, there was a somewhat shared language, I'll say it that way, of the Queen's English. And in another case, you're dealing with a second language. But we had people who lived in that culture, who we befriended very early on, to whom and through whom we could ask our core cultural questions. You know, we knew the rules were different. We just didn't sometimes know what the rules were.
Right.
And so this isn't working the way it works in the States. So how is this supposed to work? That kind of thing. And helping us to adjust to life that was being lived differently. And again, not in a sense of better or worse, just different, which means you had to figure out how to negotiate it.
Right. So having a cultural translator helps. And a lot of the students would go to ethnic churches where they could find those, you know, agents, so to speak. And some wanted to experience and had more capacity experience difference. So they would go to mainstream, typical American Caucasian church or whatever that looks like. And then they would stretch themselves a little bit more.
Yeah, and that's a fascinating example. You actually see that with missionaries over who go overseas. There are two types. I basically say there are two types of missionaries. The missionaries who cluster themselves in a primarily Western environment, even though they're in a non-Western setting, and most of their life is lived in that Westernness, and they minister out of that. And then other people who really just try and live contextually and culturally very much in the world in which they have moved into.
Mm-hmm.
Two very different experiences, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
So making also for a different kind of teaching capability, I would say, in that context as well.
And from Scripture, I can see that we're prone to settle.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, you know, God has had to kind of move his people against their will.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what fascinated me about these students, is they were willing to study transatlantically, learn, adapt, be flexible. Some of them stayed, some of them returned, and there were a host of variables that determined what those were, which I also studied, you know, what impacts their choice. But, you know, they were willing to migrate.
Now, did you figure out kind of what worked and what didn't? I mean, did you make an effort to study anything like that, or was it just a raw assessment of this is kind of the assimilation process people have to go through and wrestle with?
I most of all wanted to find what helped them culturally adjust, so that I could share that with other institutions who host foreign students.
Okay, now this is the payoff. So, so what did you find?
Well, for these religious students who are studying theology, the biggest factor that helped them were their local ethnic church. What they rated helped them the most. It wasn't the professors. It wasn't even my office.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't necessarily friends. I mean, all of those were ranked much lower. The greater factor was the local ethnic church helped, or it didn't even have to be their own ethnicity of church, but their local church was an impact, the greatest impact. So I would say whether you're studying a religious institution or not, how to help these students connect to the networks that are local networks valuable to them, definitely ethnic networks would help, so that they can get even finding the ingredients so they cook their food they're used to.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are only certain markets that sell, you know, certain things.
Right, right.
And finding where that is.
Yeah,
so.
We knew where those were in Scotland, mm-hmm, for sure. We knew where the American store was.
So I think the greatest one was finding, helping connect students to their local networks in the context they're living.
Interesting.
That are foreign and hard to find.
So that even though they had moved, there still was kind of a hand in the place where they understood how life worked, if I can say it that way.
And I think it's identity.
Yeah.
You do want to remember who you were. You know, you can't just be unstable completely.
Right.
You can have a lot of shifting, but there still has to be a base of coherence.
Mm-hmm.
And having that memory and remembrance of something you're used to is valuable.
Okay. So the local environment was important. What else helped them to assimilate?
Well, their faith, mm-hmm, which is what I, you know, if I'm making this a secular project, I just wanted to assess what they found was helpful. And over and over again, as would be expected, the way they articulated how their faith steadied them through this process was huge.
Hmm.
That was probably the largest factor. No matter what happened financially, academically, they were bolstered by this sense of, the sense of identity they were getting from God to pursue.
Now, did you get a sense of what made this experience difficult for people as well? Or
Sure. I think
yeah.
so. Lack of community.
Mm-hmm.
Everything was a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
Everything took longer to do, mm-hmm, whether going to the grocery store, not having a car, the words not meaning the same thing. I mean, it's exhausting.
That's an interesting, because we inevitably think when we go overseas, yeah, everything takes longer to do, but that's because their world's less efficient than ours. But in fact, here's some people coming to the States and everything's taking longer to do. And part of it is, if I can say it this way, I think my guess would be part of it is not knowing the rules of the game and trying to figure that out.
Yeah, just contextual clues,
uh-huh,
and situation, you know, how is, like Dutch treat.
Yeah.
People would ask you to, I had so many students, not offended, but they fear they offended the party because, uh-huh, someone would ask them out to eat and they thought, I mean, in their culture, that person pays. So
yeah,
they
right.
didn't come prepared.
Right.
It's Dutch treat. So some of that I covered at orientations, the big things that would happen over and over again, how you respond to how are you, and not to fault America for being geographically isolated because
yeah.
we are separated by oceans. We haven't
right.
been forced to interact like they have been
uh-huh.
over the years.
Yeah. Oh, there's all kinds. The list is long and interesting. And how do many people rate their experience? I mean, I'm sure you asked them in the end, did they think it was a positive or negative experience? How did they sort that out?
Everyone spoke well at Dallas Seminary.
Mm-hmm.
Their struggles, I think, were more with how limited Americans' knowledge of the world is.
Mm-hmm.
If I can say it that
yeah,
way.
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, no, we deserve the criticism sometimes.
So, and again, if you are a member of an in-group majority power, there's no motivation unless you're intentional, like, you know, me.
Right.
Thinks it's super interesting and then seeks it out. But, you know, unless you're intentional to cross boundaries in any way, and it doesn't mean leaving your city. There are plenty of places that you could go and have an intercultural experience or interracial experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I it's always interesting to in fact, it fascinates me. I do a lot of travel, obviously, in the States and overseas. And when I'm in the States and, you know, you just go to the television, little metaphor, you just go to the television. I was just in Chicago last week. And you turn on the television, the only two foreign language stations that you will see, and this has been recent, there's a French station, Le Monde has a channel. And then there is a Japanese station. Okay, that was it. You go in Europe, and you can roam the continent in the original language. There'll be an Italian channel. There'll be a German channel. There'll be a French channel, an English channel. There'll be a Croatian channel, a Russian channel. I mean, you literally get the whole full monochrome, and you watch a news report, And in the United States, if you get a foreign story, it's usually because there are American troops in a particular land or something like that. Maybe a little fascination with Britain every now and then, the royal family. But most people have no idea what's going on in Parliament. But if you watch a British broadcast almost anywhere in the world, you will get a world tour every day. You will almost visit every continent every day in the news report. It's just a different way of orienting. And actually, that's somewhat identity-driven, too, because we were very much our own country and our own people. The British tended to have a Commonwealth identity and connect, and were interconnected in that kind of a network, and it's reflected in the way they view the world. So you're right. Oftentimes, Americans have no clue about how someone from another country lives, what their values are, what drives them, what their news stories are, that kind of thing. It's we live a very isolated existence in a lot of ways.
You know, some of my African students would get asked if they lived in a tree. And, well, no, you know, one of my Liberian students was a little cheeky, and he said, I live right next to the Monrovian Embassy. So it's like a building.
Yeah, right.
So things like that. I mean, nobody, I think the students gave the best benefit of the doubt to the host country nationals that, you know, no one's trying to be offensive.
Right, right.
It's just obvious that we don't know as much about them that they know about us.
Because our experience doesn't pull us in that direction at all.
We don't have to. I mean, as soon as we're subdued by a larger, bigger, you know, whatever power, then we'd be learning.
And
like Babylonia to Israel.
Right.
You know, they had to learn how to adapt.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk. So we've talked about the experience here. Let's talk about the experience going back. What was that like for the students? And I can get the idea of the community that they came out of when they come back going, you've been Americanized.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, anywhere in the world, there's always going to be an in-group. And so that group's bias would then be, well, you've left, you're different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and anything that's I think something about the unknown, the first response is what?
Mm-hmm.
Fear.
Uh-huh.
So walls are up.
Uh-huh.
And then it'd be, you know, they go over and they have to tear down walls abroad and they come back and now there's new walls.
And, and walls from people who they didn't used to have the walls with, which is even can be a shock.
Yeah. One big thing is if they left an organization and didn't keep that communicative connection, sometimes the leadership's changed.
Right.
So in any church, you know, when leadership changed, vision changed, direction changed, ministry changes. So I think organizationally that was another difficulty, not just maybe in their local community, but organizationally, they might come back to a place organizationally that's moved, you know, literally, not out of the city, but internally moved, and they just don't fit anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So some of my foreign graduates went, they saw it as a ministry opportunity to minister in their nation, but not the same local town.
Hmm.
So I had Southern, you know, because South India is more Christianized.
Some
of them went to North India to spread the message that wouldn't be readily apparent or readily accessible. So then they had their own intercultural
move within their own
country.
Well, we those of us in the South are familiar with that when we go to the Northeast.
So
regional
difference.
Yeah, exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
So they come back and
I'll tell you one, if I may.
Okay,
interrupt,
yeah, sure.
One other big, so organizationally there were changes ministerially, there were potentially some perceived threat or, you know, who are you now? And part of it was just communicating again to get back on the same page. Locally, you know, their family hadn't changed. There wasn't any tension within the family unit per se. But what they got a lot of was that they were surprised. They got questioned why they came back. A lot, even their family's expectation would be that you have the opportunity to stay in America. Why wouldn't you?
Huh.
And so a lot culturally, it was actually a point of connection to share the gospel because the locals were like, why are you here?
Yeah.
Why did you come back? So one of my Indian students, she had a doctor's appointment or something, and the physician's a Hindu. And so they just couldn't believe she had returned. And for what reason? So then they could use it. They had actually come back because of faith motivation and a purpose, so that she was able to share that, albeit incognito, because you have to be careful with how you're saying what. But
Do the students recognize that when they come back, they have changed, and that there's something to this perception that's coming from their old?
Absolutely. Well, at least at this point, when I interviewed them, they could name what had changed, how they had changed.
Uh-huh.
So punctuality had changed.
Uh-huh.
Organizational skills had changed. Less rigid thinking.
Uh-huh.
They had moved from more black and white legalistic thinking, maybe, to how to think and more nuanced and more critically.
Uh-huh.
So they named
uh-huh.
The ways they had changed.
So they had become a foreigner to their homeland, and they understood that they were a little bit of a foreigner to their homeland.
And then it would just take extra effort to explain, you know, I'm not that different.
And, yeah.
You know, even though I'm different.
Yeah. That's interesting. So let's begin to wrap all this up and kind of put it into what kind of a package. What do you feel like you learned from doing this study? And what should we glean from what you've learned?
Well, in one sentence, I think that all of us should be more intentional about moving within who we think we are to reach out toward anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
So that internally you're actually, Christian identity is transformative, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we should be changing.
Right.
In many ways. But I think this metaphor of migration in respect to identity, that forming a faithful Christian identity requires a migration within
mm-hmm.
ourselves
mm-hmm.
toward other people.
God is moving us, and so we should be appreciative that we're on the move and appreciate what being on the move means.
And to live in a way that we can move.
Yeah.
So, you know, are you, that would go from everything physical to spiritual, is are you living in such a way that if God asked you to do something, you could?
Mm-hmm.
Because we're so burdened down with positions or possessions or whatever, you know, we'd be so strapped we couldn't be nimble.
And there's another thing that's important, I think, in what your study represents, and that is the ability to move, and I mean this, I'm saying it metaphorically, but I almost mean it literally, to move into another space, to come to understand with some sense of empathy, and go back to that word, a different space than the one you're used to. I take it that is a very important skill to be able to develop.
And I think it's biblical.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's not natural.
Yeah. So when you think of, when you say that this is biblical, do you have any specific passages in mind that take us there or anything like that? Or you?
Sure.
Yeah.
Philippians is a great one.
Mm-hmm.
And looking at the migration of God in Christ,
mm-hmm.
you could start there.
Okay. So by Philippians, you mean the example of Christ, Philippians 2, and come to engage and interact with that and come to a form of presence that didn't previously exist.
And I think in Hebrews, it's talking about how Christ is able to identify with our weaknesses. Why? Because he inhabited our space
mm-hmm.
internally, externally, physically. I mean, all of the above.
Right.
If you don't extend yourself even to the point of risk and possibly losing, I mean, in extending yourself, you're risking undifferentiation. So it's a careful balance, and, you know, it's trial and error. You don't want to become the other person, blending into them so much you don't have any differentiation. But it's that so there is a risk in trying to extend yourself that you might lose your sense of who you are.
Mm-hmm.
But that's why you do it in community and
right.
together.
Yeah, interesting. So I'm so fascinated. I don't know. I'm not sure which way to go now.
Dr. Bach's speechless.
Yeah, I do think this is fascinating. I think it's very, very hard for people to move outside who they are and develop this sense of empathy, which I actually think is important in developing community. I don't think you get community without it. So moving into that kind of space, particularly with someone who is significantly different, from a significantly different background than you are, is not an easy move to make. And I do think it is very Christian and very, you know, Jesus taught us to be open to people who come from a different background. I mean, the whole parable, the Good Samaritan, is based on the premise that the example comes from a place and possession and position that, that people weren't anticipating. And so all this is a very, very important exchange in thinking about who we are and who we extend ourselves towards. So, Jenny, I thank you for coming in and talking with us about this. It's an interesting topic. I hope your research continues to do well. I'm sure it's paid off for you well in your job in Indiana Wesleyan, and we just thank you for taking the time to be with us today on The Table.
My pleasure.
Yeah. And we thank you for being a part of The Table, and we hope you'll be back again with us soon. To examine issues where God and culture come together.
Thanks for listening to The Table Podcast. For more podcasts like this one, visit dts.edu/thetable. Dallas Theological Seminary. Teach truth, love well.